In the paper yesterday morning, there was a headline, a large, bold headline, 5/8 inch tall, across the entire page of the paper, said, "Bush, Putin can't agree on arms control." Now, that was only part of the headline, and they ran out of space as they went across because it was bolded and enlarged. And so they put the rest of the headline, the remainder of it, below that in regular type, 3/16 inch tall, 4 inches long, and they said, "But pair agree on virtually everything else." And I looked at that, and it really irritated me, and it was so typical of the way much of the news is reported today. Problems and failures are often emphasized, and even when accomplishments are recognized, they're presented in the context of the risks that still remain. Oh, you can't win over there in Afghanistan. They've been fighting for centuries, and they've defeated every army that's ever encountered them in battle. Oh, you can't find them. They'll hide in caves. Oh, they're tougher. The winter's colder. The food is shorter. The problems are more severe. It's always been loaded that you can't possibly succeed in your quest. Why didn't the large headline read, "Bush, Putin in broad agreement," since that's what indeed the truth was, and then the small headline read, "Though arms control not resolved"? That's actually what the situation was in terms of the meetings that were held in Bush's ranch. Frankly, problems sell more papers than solutions do, and negative commentary is just all too natural of a response. If we could take God's thoughts and make them into newspaper headlines, how do you think the headlines then would read? If we look at God's mind in the way that we sometimes look at the world, or as the way the world looks at the rest of the world, would God be saying, "Oh, they'll never make it. What did I expect? Why do I waste my time?" I don't think so. Don't you think that God looks more on our potential than on our personal failures, than on our struggles? Does he not look more on what he called us to? Did he not call us because we needed to learn to serve and to obey him? Or did he call us because we were the best Sabbath keepers in town, the most law-abiding citizens, the most zealous? Did he call us because we had succeeded, or did he call us because we had failed? Didn't God call us so that he could put his love in us, and so that we could learn to serve before him by the power of his Spirit in that way? When I got out of college, I had to write a resume, had to go to work. So I typed up my resume. I wanted to work for a resort, and eventually I wanted to manage one. And at that time, Walt Disney Corporation was planning to open up a resort in the Sierra Nevada Mountains someplace, I forget, in the Tahoe area, but there was some property that was being prepared. And so I typed up my resume and I sent it off to Walt Disney Incorporated, and they sent back and offered me an entry-level position standing in a Mickey Mouse suit. No. Actually, they didn't even offer that. In fact, they didn't even bother to respond. Now, I'm sure they get thousands and maybe more than that, tens of thousands of resumes way back then. But it was what I really wanted to do at that time. And what my resume essentially said was, even though I want to work at and eventually manage a resort, my resume said, "I've never really done any such thing." Isn't that what the resume says? You know, "I want this, but I've never done this, and here's why I think that I could do this." But what my resume said, "I've done some other things. Wouldn't you please focus on my potential?" That's what my resume said. How much do we focus on the potential of those around us? One of the toughest things about speaking, serving in the ministry, in some ways, is to get up and confront your own, I hate to use the term because Mike just gave us a sermonette. Can I say confront your own ghosts? Or I guess I can. I agree absolutely with what he said and taught. one of the tough things is getting up to speak and teach and not leaving some parts of the message out because of what we struggle with ourselves. And so sometimes I need to get up and address some things that are actually my goals and purposes, but not necessarily things that I have even yet obtained. Because I still have to face those issues in my life, but I can't leave them out if I haven't arrived as of yet myself. We do need to contribute toward bringing out that which is best in those around us. Not just seeing what is best, not just seeing their potential, but actually contributing toward bringing out that potential as well. We actually have opportunity to participate with God in the creation of His family's character. Now our choices, our actions, our emotions, our responses can actually impact to destroy that very same thing. But God has given us a chance to help Him, to assist Him in the production of His family's character. We can focus on what people can be, or we can just focus on what they are not. Thankfully, God focuses on our potential and not just those things and where we have failed. About 40 years ago, Chester Carlson walked into the offices of IBM in New York City, and he had in his hand a small rod, and he had a piece of fur and a mirror. And he demonstrated to them a principle that we now call electrostatic photography. The men who witnessed it at IBM did not see any commercial potential in his demonstration at all. And actually, he went to more than 20 different companies trying to demonstrate the same principle and trying to enlist their support, and they all turned him down. Finally, a small investment company worked with him to develop the process commercially, and then another product company came in and actually brought that product to the market. That company called itself at that time Xerox. Some people saw potential where others did not. Can you imagine Chester Carlson sitting in the offices of IBM with the prototype technology for a copy machine which had never yet been before demonstrated or produced, and the IBM executive simply looked at him and said, "I don't see any commercial purpose in what you're offering us at all." This little startup company that called itself Xerox said, "I think we'll bring that to market. It has potential. It will do well." There probably isn't much of a larger market in the business community today than what was developed in terms of that product and the revolutionary impact that it had. How much untapped potential do we have sitting here in our midst today, listening in the congregations, Kennewick, Lewiston, that are attached? Acts chapter 15, verse 35. We see a situation here that relates to looking at a person's potential and seeing it clearly, being able to deal with that and not just with the present reality, actually looking at the future opportunities that are there. It gives us Paul and Barnabas in Acts 15, verse 35, being here in Antioch, teaching and preaching the word of the Lord with many others also. And then after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, "Let's go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they're doing." Now Barnabas was determined to take with him John, called Mark. John Mark wrote the Gospel of Mark, so that we know who we're talking of. But Paul insisted that they should not take with them the one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. He had abandoned their party and their efforts after having committed and signing on to the trip that was at hand. He turned around, picked up his belongings effectively, and went home. Then the contention became so sharp that they departed from one another, and so Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus. But Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of God, and he went through Syria and Cilicia, strengthening the churches. Now, what's interesting here is Paul and Barnabas actually contended so strongly on this over whether or not John Mark had the potential, the character, or the utility to be considered to be used additionally in the work, that they actually couldn't work together any longer at this time. Barnabas insisted that Mark could be used and that he would help him. Paul absolutely refused to be involved and went his own way. Was Paul unrighteous, unchristian, unprofitable as a result? The Bible record is the record of what Paul did. But Barnabas had something special. If you go back, I won't turn there now, but back in Acts chapter 12 and 13, right at the end of 12 and the beginning of 13, is just a little comment that's tucked in there, and it says that they were traveling and John left them and went back to Jerusalem. He abandoned the party. You wouldn't recognize it in Acts chapter 12, but you see now later on that there was a great contention as a result. 2 Timothy 4, though, it's also interesting that the split between Paul and Barnabas was not a split in the church. They did not divide the brethren behind their own personal loyalties and against each other so that the brethren would no longer meet together. They disagreed. There was a contention. They worked separately for a time, but it never divided the church. It was not a matter of their personal ego or their personal identity and who follows me. In fact, Paul warned anybody against following him personally, obviously at the expense of the church. There's a lot of difference between the character of the biblical leaders and some of the current leaders of God's church today. 2 Timothy 4, and verse number 9. Paul now is writing from prison. It's near the end of his life. Years have passed. He's not ready to die right here. He gets out of prison, travels a short time, and then is killed. But we're reading here in a very difficult circumstance. And he says, "Be diligent to come to me quickly." 2 Timothy 4:9. "For Demas has forsaken me, having loved this present world, and has departed for Thessalonica, Crescens for Galatia, Titus for Dalmatia." Demas had forsaken him. Others had departed and were not there for various reasons. But Paul said, "I need somebody that I can depend on. I need somebody here now. Only Luke is with me. Get Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for ministry." Who maybe made him useful? Who was it that said, "No, I can use him still"? It was Barnabas. And we find as a result that Mark had the opportunity then to continue on and serve in a capacity which restored him to Paul as well. All of these individuals were eventually restored. I was fired twice in Pasadena before we were ever sent out into the field ministry. In fact, when we went out in the field ministry, it was because of the second firing. But somebody always came in and said, "Okay, fine, I don't like this, and I don't appreciate that, and this isn't what we want to do, but we can still use you again." And there's a lot of different circumstances there, and I assure you that my perspective about those circumstances possibly differs from others' perspective from the other side. We all have a way we see these things. But the fact is, I was still given opportunity to continue to serve again. I count that as a blessing. Have you ever needed to start over? Have you ever, in some way, fundamentally changed? Who would you have wanted to work for under such a time of duress when you had failed miserably in your task and yet wanted a chance to try again? Would you have wanted to have Paul is your immediate superior, or maybe Barnabas at that time? How many people would want to work for each one of us right now? If we were to stand up one by one and say, "Who wants to work for me? Who wants to work for me?" How many people would stand up and say, yes, I would work for you anytime. Barnabas had a particular gift. I don't even think, frankly, it's my main gift in any way. I marvel at what Barnabas had, and I want what he had. But we all work and serve according to our ability, and God's grace gives us opportunity in that way to continue. Acts chapter 4, verse 32. Now the multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul. This is back again at the beginning of the church. The initial persecution had begun. Peter and John had been arrested, and the church is coming together. The multitude of those who believed were of one heart and one soul. Neither did anyone say that any of the things he possessed was his own, but they had all things in common. The Bible, the church, the Word of God does not teach communism. There were times of great communion, sacrifice, sharing. The Bible also says if you don't work, you don't eat. So it doesn't mean that everyone just lives off of everyone else. But at this time, they had all things in common. There was a great willingness to share the resources they had to get the church work and the commission moving at this point and to care for the needs that were there. And with great power, the apostles gave witness to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Nor was there anyone among them who lacked. For all who were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of the things that were sold, and laid them at the apostles' feet, and they distributed to each as anyone had need. And Joseph, who was also named Barnabas by the apostles, which is translated son of encouragement, a Levite of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it, brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. So it was a time of remarkable sacrifice, but one of the individuals that stood out in this way was Barnabas. It says he had a gift in that sense of encouragement, of consolation, an ability to look and see potential. Paul was a great man, and Paul suffered greatly. And he was a fiery leader at times in what he did and stood up and the strength that he had of character to go forward. But Barnabas was a man of certain tender compassion, and it was John Mark, frankly, who needed his Barnabas at that point in time for him to be able to get up and start again. Our responsibility in the church as husbands and wives, as fathers and mothers, as children as part of that family, as members of the body is largely to help and to encourage each other. It's to help each other to be successful in our calling. God did not call us to be taskmasters over each other. He called us in the sense of the wife to be a helpmeet to each other. We're going to be the bride of Christ. We're all learning in that sense to assist as the bride. Sometimes with child rearing, it's easier just to yell and to demand compliance. And sometimes in the short term, that's very, very efficient. But it's much more effective ultimately to encourage compliance. And isn't one sign of spiritual maturity when we begin to obey God out of love rather than fear? Do we not generally start because we are afraid of the things to come? And at some point, does that not turn more into awe and respect and love and a desire to please God? Is that not part of the maturity that we develop? When you see Paul's writings, you could say, well, Paul lacked an encouragement. Let's just say Paul didn't see the potential of John Mark at that point in time. But Paul was encouraging as well. Notice how he wrote to request an offering from the Corinthian church for the poor in Jerusalem. 2 Corinthians chapter 8. He didn't just demand that they do what they had been instructed. He encouraged them. I wouldn't say he manipulated them. This is scripture. This is according to God's purpose. But he used encouragement in a way to fire them up to good works. He says, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia. And in that great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. For I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, beyond their ability, they were freely willing, imploring us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. They were giving and offering to assist in the troubles of the brethren in Jerusalem, and yet they had little, and Paul said they implored him to take that gift and share in that way. And this they did, not as we had hoped, but first gave themselves to the Lord and then to us by the will of God. So we urged Titus that as he had begun, so he would also complete the grace in you as well. But as you abound in everything, because, see, they had nothing and they gave much, Paul says, you have everything. You abound. This is the Corinthian church. In faith, in speech, in knowledge, in all diligence, and in your love for us, see that you abound in this grace also. So he built up another church and was proud of their effort, and he used that as an example to encourage the Corinthians. And he said, see that you abound in this as well. In chapter 9, notice the way that Paul bragged, actually, back and forth among the churches in terms of the good works that were done. Now concerning the ministering to the saints, it is superfluous for me to write to you, for I know your willingness, about which I boast of you to the Macedonians. He boasted of them to the Corinthians, and he boasted of the Corinthians to them. He spoke of their good works, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal has stirred up the majority. Yet I have sent the brethren, lest our boasting of you should be in vain in this respect, that, as I said, you may be ready. Lest if some Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to mention you, should be ashamed of this confident boasting. Therefore I thought it necessary to exhort the brethren to go to you ahead of time and prepare your bountiful gift beforehand, which you had previously promised, that it may be ready as a matter of generosity and not as a grudging obligation. He put the truth out. He said that it was a need for them to do this thing, but he also said it in a way where he strove to lift them up and encourage them in the process. I remember people through my life who have given me breaks at different times. My dad got me my first job for a corporate employer. I mean, I mowed lawns and weeded flower beds and shoveled walks in the snow and did those various things, and I did that a lot. But it was my dad who actually went out and spoke to one of his friends and said, would you hire my son in this job? And his friend said yes. And so I started out washing bread trucks at a bakery and then working part-time in the thrift store. And then eventually in the summer, when I learned to drive a truck, I got to have a little bread route that ran up through the mountains to the resorts, driving back and forth, dropping off bread and pastries. You know, working in a bakery must be like working in a donut shop. You eat everything you want for about 2 weeks and you level out right there. Add a whole truckload of pastries and bread and you could only eat so much. It was my dad's friend who taught me how to drive a truck. I had never driven I had just got my license, frankly, the week before, and he put me in one of the bread trucks with a stick shift in the middle and showed me what to do and started me off around the block. And I thought that was a rather risky thing to do. I had never driven one before, and he's sitting there next to me putting his own life in my hands. I made it all the way around the block perfectly well, and as I began to come into the driveway at the back of the bakery, there was another truck backing out, and I slammed on the brakes and dumped bread racks and killed the engine, not knowing to push it out of gear and push in the clutch all at once, having been driving it the very first time. And after the truck backed out and went away, he just had me put it back in gear, start the engine, and bring it up into the parking space. And he says, okay, you're ready to go. Yeah. Yeah. Once around the block with a truck, almost wreck it, driving into the driveway, and he says, all right, you're ready to go. He took a chance. I don't know if he should have even taken that chance. But he did, and I drove for them on that route in the summers and washed those trucks during the winter and worked in the bread thrift store the rest of the time, and it was the first formal corporate job I ever had. And I left that job very appreciative that it was there. There was twice in the Army that I was threatened with disciplinary action. Now, I can't imagine why these things keep happening to me. I know it's a complete fluke that these things trail behind me. Both times when I was threatened with administrative disciplinary action in the military, there was somebody who stepped in and took my side, one individual each time, when others were out to either break me in rank, see that I ended up in the brig, or punish me for my insubordination in some way. One individual both times interceded and said, "No, that is not right." Now, maybe it was right, but they didn't feel it was necessary or appropriate at that time. Fortunately, the first time, it was the commanding officer of our company, and he simply refused to accept the charges that were being pressed. The second time, it was a staff sergeant who was my personal friend who took command of my platoon long enough to vouch for me, which allowed me to return to the field with my own platoon in Vietnam by myself again. But he had to have me under his wing for a month, vouch for me that I was safe for the Army to continue to utilize, because in various ways I simply had been, as the Army would call it, insubordinate in some way. I suppose the two times I got fired in Pasadena, somebody could have used maybe that same term. But we understand that never happens again. My first sermon I ever got to give, Randy Scriber let me give it. The man that I worked for wasn't quite sure I should be giving sermonettes. Randy Scriber was in the next church area, had nothing to do with the circuit I was on, and yet he said, "Well, why don't you come over and give a sermon for me? I'm going to be gone." He didn't ask me if I'd ever given one, and I hadn't. He didn't ask me if I could give one, and I wasn't sure if I could, because I hadn't. He just said, "Why don't you come over and take the sermon on the circuit and speak in these two churches while I'm gone?" And I did. It was my first sermon, and I appreciated it very much. Terry Swaggerty is not too far from us, up in the mountains north of here. Terry Swaggerty is the first minister I worked for who let me operate out on my own. I remember sitting with a minister where you didn't open your mouth. I remember sitting with a minister when you did open your mouth, you said what he told you. I remember going everywhere you could, helping a minister, but him always keeping you at his side. And frankly, Terry Swaggerty never did want an assistant, and he told me so. But at the same time, he had to be willing to take the risk to say, "You go out and you begin to visit on your own." Somebody at some point had to make that choice. He did. I appreciated it. Those who showed faith in me in that way had an impact on my potential. 2 Timothy chapter 1. Verse 1. Paul here, in fact, verse 3, Paul here is remarking on the strength of Timothy's faith. He's getting ready to stir Timothy up to try to encourage him and strengthen him. And actually, there's a little bit of correction here, because in verse 6 he says, "I remind you to stir up the gift of God that is in you." You know, that is not just let's go out and have a good day. He's telling Timothy to fire it up a little bit, stiffen his backbone, get on with the work. But before he says that, he says, "I thank God, whom I serve with a pure conscience, as my forefathers did, as without ceasing I remember you in my prayers night and day, greatly desiring to see you, being mindful of your tears, that I may be filled with joy. When I call to remembrance the genuine faith that is in you, which first dwelt in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and I am persuaded is in you also." So Paul puts his arm around Timothy in that way and then tells him to buck up now, let's get on with the work. There was a belief in his potential and an encouragement that he would be strengthened to carry on. Brethren, if you find yourself in a position where you have need to give correction to someone, show them that you love them first. It's not easily done. Maybe it's not naturally done. But it's still what God would have us to do. We live in a society that sometimes, maybe oftentimes, focuses on negative things, and we call that freedom. Freedom to speak your mind, freedom to do what you please, freedom to come and go according to your own purposes. And in the midst of that society, we must be moving another way, going against the grain, swimming up the stream. We need to learn to be positive and to learn to encourage. Isn't that what the gospel is all about? The gospel is the good news. It's not the bad news. Now, in the midst of that gospel, there are some very tough and difficult times that God has prophesied are going to take place. As we go through the book of Revelation with Megan and Derek and Michelle and I at the Bible studies we have at home now, Friday nights. You know, we're going through the trumpet plagues, and the kids are just astounded that these things are going to happen, and they begin to think about, well, how will this affect so-and-so and so-and-so and my friend? And yet the gospel is still the good news, because it is about the fact that God is going to set up his kingdom on this earth. He's calling mankind to salvation. He forgives us. He heals us. He intercedes for us. God shows that he loves us. And then sometimes he says, now stiffen your backbone and get on with the work. Christianity is about building and maintaining a positive outlook. When you talk about Christianity, you're talking about what? Faith, hope, and as the old King James says, charity, faith, hope, and love? Well, which one of those is not positive or forward-looking or encouraging or strengthening in that way? Christianity is a transformation of the mind. 2 Corinthians 4, verse number 7. We have this treasure in earthen vessels, that the excellence of the power may be of God and not of us. God made us in flesh in this weakness for a reason. And God is perfect in power and majesty, and yet he is working in us. And we should always recognize that the power that we have in that way comes from him. We're hard-pressed on every side, but we're not crushed. We are perplexed, but we are not in despair. We are persecuted, but not forsaken, struck down, but not destroyed, always carrying about in the body the dying of the Lord Jesus, that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our body. For we who live are always delivered to death for Jesus' sake, that the life of Jesus may also be manifest in our mortal flesh. So then death is working in us, but life in you. But since we have the same spirit of faith, according to what is written, I believed and therefore I spoke, we also believe and therefore speak, knowing that he who raised up the Lord Jesus will also raise us up with Jesus and will present us with you. For all things are for your sakes, that grace, having spread through the many, may cause thanksgiving to abound in the glory of God. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Even though our outward man is perishing, yet the inward man is being renewed day by day. And he goes on and he simply describes this life, by comparison to what God has promised, is a light affliction and lasts but for a moment. We do not look at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporary, but the things that are not seen are eternal. Is that easy? No, it's not easy. But it is a goal that we must strive for. It is a direction in which we must be focused and in which we must head. One of the magazines I've taken, at least until recently, National Geographic Adventure, and there was an article in it entitled Land of the Lost. And it pointed out the difference between some individuals when they're lost in the woods or the wilderness who die and some of those who are able to survive. I think of Greg teaching survival training for the Air Force. I want to read you a couple of the points that are made in here about being lost, because there's a point here that's fundamental. The difference between who survives and who does not is not always necessarily in what equipment you have, and what knowledge you have, and what your physical circumstance is. The difference oftentimes is what is right up here in your mind. What is your approach? What is the attitude and the outlook that you maintain? And so while this is a little bit off to the side, it's very much in line with what I'm trying to address and what I'm trying to understand and apply myself. To be sure, lost is a relative term. The only time when most people are not lost to some degree is when they are home. It's making the point that you drive from here to there and you really don't know everything that is there around you. You only know what it is that you recognize as you go on your way, largely. And if you were to close your eyes and someone was to move you at that point in time, you would not have a clue what was going on. It's quite possible to know the route from one place to another without knowing precisely where you are at a given moment along the way. It rarely occurs to us that we lack real spatial orientation, such as knowing the layout of the land. Rather, we may have the illusion of being oriented. In daily life, that illusion is necessary. While our senses are capable of perceiving the world around us, the human mind is not capable of processing it in all its complexity. So we create simplified models of our environment. We're constantly maintaining a model in terms of our position. And most of the time, it's wrong. Nevertheless, the simplified model is normally good enough to get us where we're going. When it is not, though, we are lost. As I read this, again, I want you to think of this in terms of a spiritual application. 2:30. I'd like to declare today as a normal day, the kind we used to have. There's no choice but for me to be able to finish. This is a normal Sabbath. Being lost, then, is not a location. It's a transformation. Transformation of what? Of what's happening in your mind. It's not a location. Though there's no standard model for describing this mental and physical metamorphosis, the research, and it mentions various individuals here, suggests 5 general stages. In the first, you deny that you're disoriented and press on with growing urgency. In the next stage, you admit that you're lost and begin to panic. In the third stage, you calm down and form a strategy. In the fourth stage, you deteriorate both mentally and physically as your strategy fails to get you out. In the final stage, you become resigned to your plight as you run out of options. Now, this is running it all the way to full course. But it's saying, what happens to your mind as you go further and further and further down that line? You go from desperation to panic to despair to resignation. It's a process. It says, it's perhaps no surprise that this pattern closely resembles the now widely accepted stages of dying described by psychologist Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. It's what the mind goes through as you prepare to die. What it needs to go through, at least in a normal circumstance. And the end result is often the same. Once the stage of psychological disintegration is reached, death is often not far away. Psychological, it didn't say physical deterioration. It says once your mind is broken down, death is near. It's not talking about the physical strength. The ability people possess to die gently and often suddenly through no organic cause is a very real one. This is a lesson Hill knows well, referring to an individual in the article. I have photos of a man who settled into a cozy bed of pine needles after removing his shoes, pants, and jacket, setting his wallet on a nearby rock. Hill says in the photos he seems so peaceful it's hard to believe he's dead. Now, let me continue. Who makes it and why? One of the great riddles in the study of survival is why some people live while others, often facing less difficult conditions, die. And it's not who you'd predict either, says Hill, who has studied the survival rates of different groups. Sometimes the one who survives is an inexperienced female hiker, while the experienced hunter gives up and dies in one night, even when it's not that cold. Among healthy people, he says, the category that has one of the highest survival rates is children 6 and under. That's a shock. When I read that, I thought 6 and under. The very people we're most concerned about. Despite the fact that small children lose body heat faster than adults, they are in a worse physical circumstance than anybody else. They often survive in the same conditions better than experienced hunters, better than physically fit hikers, better than former members of the military, and one of the groups with the poorest survival rates is children 7 to 12. Clearly, those youngest children possess some secret that trumps knowledge and experience. It is not the physical circumstance that puts us the most at risk. It's what goes on in our mind. Isn't that the way we face our lives spiritually? It's not the trial, it's not the test. That may be the generating issue, but it's how we process that and how we look at it in our mind. Scientists do not know exactly what the secret is, but the answer may lie in some very basic childhood trait. Small children do not create complex mental maps. They don't understand traveling to a particular place, so they don't run to get somewhere beyond their field of vision. They also follow their instincts. If it gets cold, they crawl into a hollow tree to get warm. If they're tired, they rest, so they don't fatigue. If they're thirsty, they drink. They try to make themselves comfortable, and staying comfortable keeps them alive. Children ages 7 to 12, on the other hand, behave much like adults. They panic and run. Panic is a mental circumstance, not a physical situation. They look for shortcuts. If the trail peters out, they keep going, ignoring thirst, hunger, and cold until they fall over. In learning to think more like adults, it seems, they have suppressed the very instincts that might have helped them to survive. Again, I think there's a point there in terms of what we look to and how our focus is. You know, God says He gives us peace. We need peace spiritually to survive. We cannot live our lives in a physical or mental panic. Lack of leadership in a survival situation can be fatal. Leach writes in Survival Psychology, because I'm skipping big blocks of this, obviously, I got to keep this within a normal service today. He tells of the fishing boat, West One, which sank in the Pacific, leaving 8 members of the crew floating in 2 life rafts. Intermission while I turn the page. Which were tethered together by a 30-meter line. 2 life rafts in the same place, in the same weather conditions, with 2 different groups in the rafts, only 30 meters apart. In one raft, the third mate quickly took charge, setting watches, assigning the men chores. In the second raft, which included the captain, no leader emerged. Instead of discipline, there was disintegration. Leach writes, when the crew was rescued 2 weeks later, the men in the first raft climbed aboard the rescue ship under their own power. Those in the second, who had been only 30 meters away, were helpless, had to be carried aboard. The captain had already succumbed to the elements. Establishing a definite purpose to one's existence strengthens survival. To structure your life, to have purpose, and to have steps that you walk through to fulfill that purpose gives you focus and mental strength in which to survive. Why did God give us a work to do? Why didn't He just say, well, just hang around and stick it out, and when you're done, then I will save you? He gave us a work to do. He gave us marriages. He gave us children. He gave children parents. He gave us relationships. That's what unity is about. Unity is not feeling good. Unity is choosing to work together. Unity is turning the other cheek. Unity is submitting yourself. Marriage is submitting yourself one unto the other. It is not because it feels good. I asked somebody this week, when you come up to a stop sign, do you decide to stop based on whether you feel like it, or do you stop because you know you must? Because if you're waiting until you feel like it, you'll probably not last very long. And do you wait until you feel like it by stopping, and then when you finally feel like it, then you'll be all right? No, you may never feel like it. You will always have to stop. It's a choice. It's a choice we have to make. The breaking down of a person's aim or purpose into simple tasks so that life can be handled one step at a time is how a person develops and builds strength and maintains themselves in a focus. It goes on and it begins to describe a checklist of specific things a person has to do in order to survive. Let me just read you the beginning of that. You have only so much water, so much energy, so much emotion stored inside you. Every time you exert yourself, you use them up. The heart of this teaching is learning to be stingy with the scarce resources you have. And to help to reinforce the idea, the individual at this part of the article recited a 7-point survival checklist used by the Air Force and other groups. And do you know what point number one is on the checklist? Positive mental attitude is point number one. That's before first aid. That's before shelter. That's before fire, signaling, water, or food is your mental attitude and approach. Step one comes first. You have to take responsibility for your own survival. Brethren, we're here to help each other, to encourage each other, but we cannot save each other. We have to take our own responsibility for that. You have to take responsibility for your own survival. You can't just sit back and let someone else do it for you. Rarely do we take true responsibility, though, for our actions. We live in a culture of lifeguards, of insurance, of lawsuits, where someone else is always responsible and someone else is always to blame. But take one wrong turn in the woods, and then it says, or actually, more aptly, take one wrong turn in your mind, and we go directly back to the Stone Age. Now, brethren, if we can take and apply that spiritually, I really believe in terms of survival, we are each responsible to God and nobody can carry us through. We need to help each other, encourage each other, but that process of survival starts and fundamentally takes place in the mind. We need to encourage each other to strengthen the mind, to build up, to lift up. I need to do that too, but it's what we've been called to do. We need to determine to contribute as much as we can to the lives of those around us. Paul was more concerned with the needs of the church than he was for himself. He sacrificed himself for the church. And I think doing so very probably, possibly helped him to keep from focusing too much on his own troubles by going outward and contributing to help someone else. James and Peter both wrote to encourage the church even as they were approaching their own deaths. When those circumstances were there, their minds were not on themselves. Philippians 2 is a point again, Paul speaking, but notice Philippians 2. If there is any consolation in Christ, any comfort in love, any fellowship of the Spirit, if any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out, not only for his own interests, but also for the interests of others. Brethren, it's a survival technique to structure yourself in such a way as to be of service to those around you. God didn't call us so that we would just be encouraged all by ourselves. He called us to offer encouragement to others as well. We need to look for ways to assist, to help those around us. We need to contribute to others so that they might reach their potential in accomplishing God's purpose. We have a tremendous opportunity, brethren, to assist God in preparing his people for his kingdom. Let us help each other to accomplish and to produce as much as we possibly can.